Welcome to Paleo Party, an interactive podcast hosted by Drs. Dunn, Dean, and Clements. It is our pleasure to be with you tonight, and it's my pleasure to introduce our special guest for the evening. He's a beard aficionado, and he's officially Eurovision's number one paleontologist fan, and he's our go-to fishy expert. It's Dr. Richard Deirdrin, everyone!
Hello. You might get some disputation about paleontology's number one Eurovision fan.
I'm literally wanted to start the controversy early.
Riot in the Twitch comments.
So we are asking all of our guests to attempt to explain their research using the OpGorify text editor, which only allows you to use the top 1,000 most commonly used words in English. Obviously, this is a bit extreme, and we've had a go at it ourselves. You can check it out on our webpage. But I believe that, Richard, you have prepared one for us tonight. Would you like to take it away?
Okay. Today, in the great waters of the world, live animals with large grey forms and huge biting teeth. Once, when the world was young, so were they. Little things in small, sweet waters, food for many. These animals' forms are stuck in time, written in the rocks. I study what these little animals look like and how they lived through time as they went from little to big and moved between small and great waters. I do this by firing light at the written rocks. Thick bits light up white, showing the animals inside. With a computer, I make pictures of what these animals look like and work out their family tree to understand the story of how the children of their children today came to be. The end.
Oh my goodness. Wow! Was that a poem?
Yeah, it wasn't really a poem. I don't think it was.
Oh my words. Pure poetry.
What the heck? Well, not just me, but chat is genuinely amazed. Like, people are freaking out.
Thanks, chat.
Some couplets in there, man. That was from the soul. That was great.
Yeah, I think we're done here. Let's wrap it up. Let's go home.
Yeah, that's it. Game over. Actually, you know what? I feel like I was going to give you a paleo party point for that. But I actually feel like I have to take that away because you've put everyone else to shame and you've now set the bar so high for everyone else that Soz.
Okay, I'm sorry to hear that.
So that you're only on your original one.
Single point, still more than, I would say, most 99% of the world's populace has. 99.999.
As amazing as the poetry was, I think I kind of got the gist, but would you like to put some sciencier words in there and explain what your research is in plain language?
Yes. So I'm interested in the very earliest relatives of the cartilaginous fishes. So today, the cartilaginous fishes are sharks and rays, which are together called the elasmobranchs, and this other group called chimeras, which is all these weird deep sea things. There aren't very many of them, and they're kind of weird. And so these are all the cartilaginous fishes, so-called, because they have cartilaginous skeletons, as opposed to the bony fishes, which have bony skeletons, in theory. And so I'm interested in how the cartilaginous fishes evolved. And so I look at their very earliest relatives, which are in the fossil record, from the kind of late Paleozoic, so like the Devonian through to the Permian.
What kind of, how many millions of years ago is that, roughly?
The heyday is in like, the heyday of some of the things I look at, which are called Acanthodians, which are these particularly rubbish fossils from the Paleozoic. You kind of get most of them in the early Devonian. So that is like 400 million years ago-ish.
Long haul.
And then you get various exciting, more sharky things throughout until the, well, into the Permian and Carboniferous, which is like maybe 300 and something million years ago-ish.
Oh, nice.
A long time.
Yeah, that is a long time. And that's, but also that's a long time to be around for, right? Like several hundred millions of years. That's not a short stay.
Yeah, good innings for the
good innings.
Fossil sharky boys.
such an English way of describing fossil fish. Oh, bloody good innings.
So I'm going to jump in at this point and briefly remind listeners, guests, everyone that we are an interactive podcast. Right. So if you have any questions for Richard or for any of us about anything, be that fishy related facts, be that anything else, be that beards, Eurovision, send in your tweets, send in your comments on the Twitch chat, and we will do our best to get around to them. But yeah, I wondered if we should dig in a little bit more to some of these fishy, along this fishy train. Mm-hmm. And so I'm going to start with something that I think is fairly common knowledge now, thanks to a certain podcast. But I've heard that, that your research field is a lie, because there is no such thing as a fish. I don't know if you have any words to say, if you have any defense against this at all.
Well, I guess the reason people say that is because fish, if you take all fishy things, they aren't a true group because they include tetrapods, i.e. things with four legs that chunter around on land. And if you remove them, then they're no longer a true group. But I would counter argue that really you should just include tetrapods as fish and unite everything in one great fishy whole.
That's a big change.
Ladies and gentlemen, I would like to say that that's not the oh fish full stance that most paleontologists have.
I admire your ambition though. In your Opgora 5, you mentioned that you use light to have a look at their family tree, or I'm probably like condensing that a lot. Can you explain what you mean by light in this sense?
Yeah, so I was trying to find a way of talking about CT computer tomography, so like CT scanning and stuff, where you fire x-rays at a fossil or something in the rock, and then the difference in either density or phase contrast between the fossil and the surrounding rock will allow you to look inside, like a CAT scan in a hospital, but with more powerful x-rays.
Nice.
Light was the closest I could get to that.
Makes sense. It totally works.
So basically what you're saying is that you find lots of old, very old fossil fishies, and then you zap them with the synchrotron, which we have talked about in episode one. So if you'd like to find out more about the synchrotron, please go back and listen to our first episode. But once you've zapped them and with the synchrotron, so you produce these really powerful x-rays, which means you don't have to break the rock apart, you don't have to break the fossil. What do you do then with the, what do you do when you've got these scans? Like what is your actual work?
So when you scan these things with x-rays, and then that means that you put them on a little spinning platform, and then you get an image through it from each angle. And using some fancy mathematics, you generate a series of slices through the object. And then say, like, if you imagine you have a fish like this, and then it's sliced like that lengthways. And then if you work your way through those slices, you can follow the sort of shapes along. And if you imagine if you drew over the fish for one of the slices and then drew over it on the next slice and the next slice and the next slice, you could put all those drawings together to get like a 3D fish. And so that's sort of how it works.
For anyone not able to see the live stream right now, there are wild hand gestures to explain what's going on.
There's lots of gesticulation going on.
Caught a fish this big.
Yeah,
exactly. So then once you've got your fancy images, what do you do with them?
So then the reason behind trying to acquire these images is that lots of these fossils, because the sharks have these cartilaginous skeletons, lots of the fossils are pretty rubbish. And so we're trying to like extract information from these pretty horrible fossils that we can't make that much of from just looking at the fossil. And so once we have the images, we use those to reconstruct the anatomy of these animals in 3D. And then we can use that information to either feed into, this is what I was talking about, family trees, either feed into phylogenies to try and work out how all these fishes are related. And what that tells us about the order in which, traits evolved, for example, in cartilaginous fishes. Or you could use it, I guess, to look at things like functional morphology, if you wanted to, or how the shape varies in different fishes and what that can tell you about ecology and things like that. So you could get lots of different kind of strands of information from these.
Speaking of catching big fish, how big are these fish that you're working on? Are they like a huge range of sizes or just like...
Yeah, so that's kind of an interesting question actually, because so today, if you think of sharks, right, you have like the biggest one is the whale shark and the smallest one is a dwarf lantern shark, which gets to 30 centimeters long. I think that's right. Someone might furiously correct me in the comments. But so they're still quite big. Even the small one is still a fairly chonky fellow. Whereas lots of these things that lived in these Acanthodians, these very, very earliest cartilaginous fishes that lived in the mainly in the Devonian, lots of them, they get as small as like that big. And lots of them are living in like lakes and stuff like that. So they're living in completely different environments and they're very different sizes. And they're probably doing very different things ecologically. Like they're probably, I don't know, this is wild speculation, but like equivalent to like sticklebacks or like small lake fish and things like that. They're doing all these ecological things which sharks just don't do today.
That is so cool.
That's pretty amazing. That's, yeah. So I just had a quick Google because I don't know anything about dwarf lantern sharks and they are pretty weird. But apparently the largest they grow is only 20 centimeters. So tiny little critters. They look weird. I don't know if the picture of the one was dried out, but it looked very wrinkly. Are they wrinkly?
I presume it's, I think they're from quite, they're quite deep. Deep sea things. So I guess they don't look their best when you bring them to the surface.
It was a very fleeting situation that I saw the picture. So we've got a good question already. We've had a couple of questions coming in, and don't forget that you can ask us questions on the live stream. Let me start again. What is the weirdest thing that you have seen in CT scans of fish?
The weirdest thing. I'd like to have a fun and interesting answer to that, but I'm not sure I do. Sometimes you see like weird faces in them, like in you're staring at this data set for hours and hours and you see like this ghostly face in the corner and worry that you're trapped in an extremely boring ghost story about a PhD student with a CT scans. But there's nothing that exciting because the thing is, because they're fossilized, I guess you could get exciting things in them, like an embryo or something. But
counteract you here. I think you did see something very exciting in a fossil recently that has been very recently published in a paper.
Oh, we did. That's true.
For the audience, what I was, let me just clarify what had happened. Basically, a question just popped up on the live chat, and I thought that is a perfect way to segue into Richard's latest work. But Richard missed that piece of bait, but Christopher has shoaled with him, and they are all working together perfectly.
Yeah, thanks. I was so busy thinking of a funny comedy answer that I couldn't arrive at the actual interesting answer. So that paper was about this placoderm, which is this stem group jawed vertebrate. So jawed vertebrates are bony fish plus cartilaginous fishes, and they diverged at some point in the Paleozoic. And these placoderms are fishes that branched off before the two groups diverged. So they're like
a very, very long time ago.
A very, very long time ago. And so this is like this Devonian placoderm called Mingenia, and it has endochondral bone in it, which is like, if you imagine if you took a bone, like a leg bone, and cracked it open and looked inside it, you'd see that it had like a hard bone around the outside, which is called perichondral bone, and then sort of trabecular struts inside, like supporting the bone. If you imagine a sheep bone or something, they have these little struts inside. I'd say that's that internal bone. And we used to think that that kind of bone was only in bony fishes and that was a specialist thing that bony fishes had. But in Mingenia, this early jawed vertebrate, we found that it has this bone in its brain case, which demonstrates that it is, that this bone possibly, if it is homologous with the bone in bony fishes, evolved before the split of cartilaginous fishes and bony fishes, and that cartilaginous fishes have lost it. But the evolution of hard tissues is really confusing. Like lots of early chondrichthyans have bone and cartilage, and current chondrichthyans' cartilage is really weird. There's lots of exciting tissue stuff going on.
That's actually segues quite nicely onto something which I just wanted to just sort of talk about for the audience. So a lot of our audience will probably have never seen a CT scan to them, a fossil is just a something that's on a rock or has been removed from the rock like a bone. Mm-hmm. So when you're CT scanning these things, effectively all you're looking at is the bone, because I presume most of the soft tissues have decayed away before it turned into a fossil. So when you're doing that kind of work, how are you literally just basing all of your work based on just the bones, or are you looking at other things as well? Are you looking at parts of the bone that will give you clues about the soft tissues, or are you only interested in the hard parts?
Usually what you get is the bones, and most of the things are quite flattened. Though some of these fishes, the cartilage is preserved. So again, in that paper I was talking about just then, we had one of these acanthodians, these early chondrichthyans, where the cartilage was preserved and you could see it in the synchrotron scans. You could even see the little cell spaces in the cartilage were still there.
Whoa.
It was pretty crazy. So occasionally you get cartilage. But yeah, we are looking for hard tissue characters that we can compare to other fish to work out how they're related. But having said that, you can make some soft tissue inferences. Like say if you had a nice 3D skill, you could try and work out where some muscles were and that kind of thing. But it's a bit more difficult than say in dinosaurs or something, or tetrapods, because they have very modulous, well, they have skulls which are kind of where everything is attached, whereas these fishes have lots of different bits to their skull and they all fall apart. And there's not like a box to base everything around necessarily.
The reason why I asked that as well was because we had a question, which is, do you use UV light as well? But I just wanted to quickly interject there that UV light is not very good for looking inside rocks. You can only use UV light for looking on the surface. And generally, UV light, I mean, I guess you could use it. It would make bones fluoresce. But I use it particularly for looking at soft tissues. But if you're not finding many soft tissues, then is UV light particularly useful in your work?
I mean, no one really uses it. I've never seen anyone use it with paleozoic fishes, but I could be wrong. But I think I have seen it. I'm trying to remember where. But anyway, so I'm looking for these 3D fossils, which are in the rock just because they're 3D. But it's not a bad point. Like if you had lots of these fishes are really flat, so maybe you would get interesting things from some of them using UV light. And some of the places, like it's a place called Gogo in Australia, which has these amazing Devonian fishes. Like once they get prepared out of the rock and they look like a skull that's washed up on a beach or something. And they preserve muscle tissue, I think, in the rock. But they're also 3D, so I don't know. I guess you'd struggle to use UV light to look at them. Sorry, go on.
I was going to say, if you follow our Twitter account, you'll see that we have been doing some fishy facts, courtesy of Jake, our fishy boy. You can, from the Gogo formation, you can find an umbilical cord from a baby fish, which is mind-blowing. I didn't even
think of cool that stuff.
I can't imagine that being preserved in the fossil record. It's insane.
Go and check it out.
Ho, ho, ho! Ho, ho, ho!
I was just thinking that, so when I think of cartilage, I immediately think of like what our ears and nose are made of. I don't think there's anything else cartilage about us that's visible on the outside. But if we were to be fossilized and we were that old, how likely is it that our cartilage would be preserved and that when we were CT scan that you'd actually know that we had these weird flaps and pointy thing?
I think often it doesn't, but one of the interesting things about cartilaginous fishes is that the cartilage is actually kind of special. So your cartilage is just like proteins and stuff, I think. Don't quote me on that, or record me on a live video.
I was just about to say you are being recorded for perpetuity.
But if you look at cartilaginous fishes' cartilage, it's impregnated with kind of calcium and things. So if you go to a fish market and look at a dried shark specimen with all the cartilages, and you look very closely, you'll see that on the surface of its cartilages, there's loads of tiny little hexagons which are all interlocked. And this is called tessellate prismatic calcified cartilage. And basically what they've done is they've got this support structure of little hexagons all over the surface of the cartilage. And this is kind of acts to strengthen the cartilage and means that they can do things with the cartilage, like chomp shells and swim around, and then they don't just become bendy boys and float all over the place.
I was just going to say, I couldn't imagine the cartilage of our ears and nose like doing anything useful.
Also,
I quite like the little burn there right at the beginning, which was like, their cartilage is better than your cartilage, Emma.
Yeah, sorry, not Emma's cartilage.
Is this the tetrapod thing? I understand it. It's okay.
Yeah. So this developed somewhere in the evolution of cartilaginous fishes, and it's actually quite an interesting. There's some interesting sort of this sequence of development of this cartilage as it evolves. But in lots of these very early, these acanthodians, these Devonian guys, they have some bone. So some things tend to be ossified, like their shoulder girdle, like what their fins is attached to, because that is needs to be hard. But then other parts of their skeleton don't have these little tesserae. And some parts of their skeleton seem to be cartilage but all be calcified, and then they preserve, and other bits seem to be cartilage but not calcify. So they're doing all these cool tissue-based experiments as they evolve with mineralizing cartilage and
that to try and support them.
Yeah, it's kind of interesting. You always think of, I know things are weird at the beginnings of groups, like there's a lot of experimentation and whatnot, but you always think that like bone is just bone, or like cartilage is just cartilage. You don't really think about how that's had to kind of.
But I mean, the counter to that though is think about how weird things are, like hair. Hair to us is just something which I put wax in so that I look vaguely normal in the mornings. But like rhinos use hair to like poke other rhinos.
Yeah,
aggressively.
It's also worth mentioning that not this isn't related to rhino poking, but that in your body, cartilage and internal bones, like your long bones, as they develop, you get like a cartilage template laid down first. So cartilage and bone, even in us, has like a developmental relationship. Mm. So
that is going into like a fascinating area of paleontology, like Evo Devo, evolutionary developmental biology. It is absolutely fascinating that we all kind of look the same when we're embryos and then we become just so different later on. If you want a rabbit hole, audience, please do go for it.
One of my favorite things is like those people that have the pores behind their ears, which are the evolutionary remnants of when we had gills.
Chris's face was a picture.
Chris is freaking out, but I'm not lying. This is absolutely true. So
do I have them?
Maybe. You are a bit fishy, if I'm brutally honest. So Richard has alluded to this kind of already. So there's this big question. If you're into categorizing animals into groups, which some people are, they have a big problem with the term fishes. Because, as Chris has already pointed out, every organism that lives on the land has evolved from fishes of some form or another. So therefore, we're all fishes. But because of that, we have these like weird evolutionary hang-ups. So when we're developing from embryos, we are basically kind of develop gills. And in some people, they don't disappear. Not gills, but like gill arches and things. And they don't disappear. So some people have these little pores behind their ears. And they're the leftover of gills. It doesn't mean they can breathe underwater. They are not superheroes. And I now also realize that friend of the show, Jim Jam, has who, by the way, also is the contributor of many fish facts, which Paleo Party has been using. He has quite rightly said in the chat that everyone in the audience is probably now frantically checking behind their ears. And if you do find any pores, I would like you to come on the chat and tell us about your weird gills, please. Thank you. That's the end of my rant. Mm. Thank you for listening to my TED talk.
This is blowing my mind. I'm like, yeah, I kind of want to go and check, but I'm on a podcast, so I can't. You just need to wait.
Yeah, please stay with us for a moment. Yeah. You can check your gills later. It's fine.
Yeah, I'll give it time.
I wanted to segue a little bit, if we may. Richard, I know that you go fossil hunting in your spare time, and you are particularly good at it, as far as I can tell, in comparison to me, who is absolutely awful at it. But I wanted to hopefully ask you to talk a bit more about that. How do you choose your sites? Where do you go? How do you do this?
Well, I've not done that much fossil hunting. I've done some, but I wouldn't like to be accused of being particularly good at it. But I've collected in a few places. So I went on trips to Mongolia during my PhD with Martin Buzzo, my supervisor. And we also went to the Northwestern Territories of Canada to look for fossil sharks. And then I've also done collecting in sort of the Welsh borders and Scotland in the UK. And so for those in the Northwest Territories, we were sort of tipped off that this place had these sort of 3D sharks in concretions. And so we got on a helicopter and went out to look at it. And then we spent sort of a week looking and found this one specimen which had exploded all the way down a hill and was sort of scattered down a shale slope. And we sort of scrabbled around trying to find all the little bits of the concretion, and then it ended up with one specimen which was probably somewhere between 40 and 60% of a concretion that once had a fossil shark head in that didn't all fit together. Okay. So
you got to go in a helicopter.
Yeah. Well, in theory, it's a really cool, potentially a really cool site. It's just very expensive to get to. And then in the Welsh borders in Scotland, we've more been looking for places where we know we already find stuff. Like people have been describing fishes from them for like 200, approaching maybe 150 years or something. And so you kind of know what you're going to find.
All of those sites are rather extremes of weather conditions. Well, Scotland and Wales aren't necessarily extreme, but Mongolia can get really cold, and Northwest Territory is not much better.
Yeah, well,
do you like the cold?
I don't specifically like the. I think I prefer to do fieldwork in like alpine areas than in a desert. That would be my. I'm not really designed for deserts. I can't wear a fisherman.
He says wearing a turtleneck jumper.
Yeah,
I was gonna say.
But yeah, I don't know. I've never been on sort of one of these sort of dinosaur trips where people they have a massive camp and drink beer and stuff. Ours are like have all been like in the Northwest Territories. We were sort of keeping everything in a big pelly case to stop bears from getting at our food, and then we had to walk up to get it to have breakfast every morning, and then walk around and go to the toilet in the great outdoors and sleep inside a bear fence and all that kind of stuff. So
bear fence. Mm. Do you have to build this, or is it in like areas that you travel
to?
No,
the bear builds it. The bear comes along and then he offers and he's like, can I build you a fence? You're like, yeah, of course, no problem.
Yeah. That's it's like a little pop-up thing. It's got like plastic sticks and then you put a weak electric, I guess a reasonably strong electric fence. No one tested it, but like, around the outside of the campsite.
Oh dear.
Yeah, I've never done fieldwork in bear territory. That sounds rather frightening.
Go on, Chris. I'll let you go ahead.
Thomas, you go ahead.
Oh gosh. Oh, we're being so I was literally just gonna quickly ask. So if some of our listeners have never been fossil hunting before but want to go fossil hunting in the UK, could you offer them any advice or tips? Things not to do?
Can I start with things to do?
Yes, that would probably be better, yes.
So I think there's lots of really cool places to go fossil hunting in the UK. Like there's the kind of your normal sort of locations like along the Jurassic Coast and stuff, but I'm going to talk about Paleozoic fossil fish because they're better than ammonites. So,
strong claims.
Third controversy of the evening.
Oh, whoa. I nearly pressed the technical difficulty button. You just offended me and probably one other person in the whole world.
But there's some of the places, particularly in Scotland, you can find like articulated fishes. So what I would do is look up a place to go. And lots of them are like old quarries and stuff, and look up what the things you would be looking for look like before you go. That's a key thing, because you don't want to be bumbling around not really actually knowing what you're looking for. And then the main thing with fossil hunting is just patience. Like you just have to look for absolutely ages and then see what you find. Like I went fossil hunting with my family in near Ludlow this summer. I dragged everyone to this sort of raining location in a forest where it's quite a nice trilobite locality. And me and one of my brothers sat down and just looked in the mud for half an hour and found loads of nice trilobites. And everyone else looked for a minute and then got bored and stopped looking. And so you want to be one of the people that's looking for a long time patiently. That's how you find fossils. It's not by magic or you just keep on looking.
I see where I've been going wrong.
Yeah.
I swear there's a thing about paleontologists bringing people on these kind of fossil hunting becoming a part of like any holiday you go on. Because back a fair few months ago now, I went to Coniston up in the Lake District with some friends and sort of like mini retreat. And I heard about there being a big trilobite quarry nearby. I was like, right, who wants to hike up this mountain with me? Somewhat unsurprisingly, no takers. No one wants
no,
to take.
No, really?
One person who did geology and paleontology at undergrad. So it's a shame. I can understand people's lack of patience.
Yeah, I guess I kind of naively thought that everyone would want to do it, but turned out that I'm just like a sad man with a fixation on fossils that I never lost.
But I mean, I'm going to rock the boat a little bit here, and as a professional paleontologist, I am one of those people. I have the attention span of a gnat, and Well, I go fossil hunting. I'm one of those people who skit from like rock to rock. I'm moving my hand very quickly for those of you who can't see what I'm doing right now. But I'm gesticulating a fly's movement. I have no patience. So I did some field work recently. We went to China and we were splitting shales, and it was the most we were finding amazing things like bits of dinosaur and fossil fish and fossil birds, but it was the most mind-numbing thing I've ever done. I'm really bad.
I think that's another tip I'd offer to viewers at home would be that you should choose a place, if you're just starting, where you're likely to actually find stuff. Like some places you can look for like an hour and it's a good rate of recovery to find like one thing every 3 hours or something. And they're probably not starter locations.
So that's, I think that's one thing about the Jurassic Coast. I think the Jurassic Coast, often people will often go there because it's so famous for its fossils, but actually finding fossils there is really difficult because so many people like pick the coast and there are so many professional fossil hunters that live around there that the coast is often picked clean long before you get to the beach. So you get to see lots of bits of ammonite, and you can see the amazing rocks and the ammonite graveyards, which are the large limestone slabs, which have lots of ammonites in them, but you can't actually collect those fossils. So I think you're right. I think trying to get off the beaten path is often quite good.
Yeah.
We've got one comment in the chat, which is that according to a professor, apparently, who works at the National Museum of Scotland, I won't name names, a key rule for fossil hunting was that there has to be a pub nearby. Now, I think there's two important things that we should talk about here. The first thing is that there have been studies that have shown that you find lots of fossils, like more fossils, near pubs for two reasons. Firstly, car parks. Secondly, also because I think most paleontologists are probably borderline alcoholics. But I also...
Sweeping generalization.
I'm a sweeping generalization. Stereotypes are there for a reason. I speak as an alcoholic. I speak as an alcoholic myself. Okay, and also, but the second thing I wanted to bring up, which is actually a serious point and not joking around, is that I think that there's a big misconception that you have to be able to climb a mountain to do fossil hunting. And I think that there's a very ableist rhetoric sometimes in this idea that we have about, you know, paleontologists have to be out in the rain all the time. And I think there are plenty of places that you can get to that are accessible if you're, you know, if you can't necessarily walk up a mountain for whatever. I mean, I only have one knee, so I fall into that camp. And I think, you know, I think it was important to say that at this point, you can get out and fossil hunt even if, you know, you can't climb a mountain. That's cool. We're cool with that.
I would 100% agree. I would say, I would raise the point that one of the best fossil sites for early Paleogene, so just after the big impact that wiped out the dinosaurs, one of the best fossil sites, it's recovered mammal skulls and all these other bits and pieces, was recently found about a 5 minute walk or less than that, like from an airport in Colorado. Yeah. It's literally next to the airport. You could step outside and you're on it. There are fossils everywhere. There's fossils beneath your feet. They're all over the shop.
Absolutely.
Don't worry about it. You can find them all over the place. You don't have to climb a mountain to do so.
There's plenty of them in city centres. Or if you want to see some.
I was just going to say.
I'll let you take over then. Please.
Oh, I was just going to say, we walked by a big pillar full of corals the other day. It was beautifully speckled and you wouldn't really think much of it. It looked almost marbled. But on closer inspection, there was all these rugose corals and they were just absolutely stunning, right slap bang in the city centre of Birmingham.
Yeah, absolutely. And like most shopping centres have nice polished stones for the sort of, you know, the floors. So sometimes you get fossils in there. So there's plenty of urban fossils to be found as well.
What's, I think that's all. Tuna teas.
Oh, that was a fantastic pun.
Oh, get it. good time to plug. There's a Twitter account. I think it's called Urban Geology or Urban Paleontology. Might want to double check that.
Urban Fossils, isn't it?
Oh, okay.
I think it's Urban Fossils.
There's a Twitter account that is really good at this and really points out some really great spots you can easily get to if you're in a city center, so you don't even have to go into the countryside. Fossils everywhere. It's great.
In Edinburgh there's some beaches along the Firth which they're called the Granton shrimp beds, and you find lots of carboniferous shrimps, but you also find these 3D shark skulls. Ooh. Some of them are like the best specimens of these fossils in the world, and they're just like on this beach with lots of dog poo bags and rubbish on.
Lovely.
So
glamorous.
Well, there's even fossils that have come from, well, subfossils as well as fossils that have come from the Thames in the middle of London. I know some of them get washed out slightly further than the middle of London, but yeah, hippos and stuff like that. So yeah, this is really going far from Richard's research into fish, but
Yeah, I'm desperately trying to trawl through Twitter to find the urban fossils. And it's not urban fossils. I've just searched that and that is not correct.
Shouldn't have mentioned it without knowing it.
I think there's one. Someone in chat has said pavement geology.
That's the one.
Oh,
nice.
Wow.
Thank you to whoever mentioned that.
That was friend of the show, Jim Jam. One paleo point for you, Jim Jam.
Good job, Jim Jam.
Good work.
Jim Jam's like, yes!
I was going to follow this up on topic but slightly off topic, saying you've been to some really, really cool places. Mongolia is a place I've always wanted to go to for fossils, so very jealous of that. But if you, this latest find, this latest paper that you had out a few weeks ago, was it not Mirror something? I can't remember its name.
Mingenia.
What does that mean?
It's named after this guy called Mingin, who I think was I never met him because it was before the time I went, but I think he was like someone from the paleo department in Ulaanbaatar in Mongolia. So, and I think he died, so it's like a tribute to
him. Nice.
Wholesome fossil name.
But yes, Mingenia, this fish has kind of turned over our understanding of the early evolution of fishes and us as a broader thing. What out of the places you go, what could be the coolest thing that you could find? Like, is there anything that you're when you're splitting shells for hours at a time or hammering open these concretions, is there anything that you're particularly hoping that you'll stumble across when you're doing it?
I guess lots of these early chondrichthyans are so horrible and don't fossilize skeletons. There's always the chance that you might find one that's sort of like fossilized in three dimensions or whatever. And if you could find an internal skeleton of one of them in 3D, then that would be it would be very exciting for early shark scientist people. So that would be my personal fave. But Mingenia is probably, I wasn't even there when they found Mingenia. I was just involved in the paper. But they, but that's kind of exciting on sort of a broader, like evolution of major vertebrate characters level. So that's pretty cool. I'd say that ranks pretty high in the excitement indices.
Excitement or index.
Is there one index?
I like that.
I like it too.
So we've got another question, which I'm going to slightly tweak the wording of. But the question is, do you use 3D printers in your work? Do you use 3D printers in your work?
That is a good question. So I'm hoping to. I'm currently working on acanthodes, which is this, you have all these horrible acanthodians, and only one of them has lots of skeletons that are preserved in 3D, and it is Acanthodes. But most of them were discovered in like the 19th century and were acid prepared because it's in this iron stone, so you can't prepare the fossil out of the rock. You have to prepare the fossil, you have to destroy the fossil to get a mold, basically. But we found some in the collection, some that haven't been acid prepared, and we CT scanned them. And so now we've got 3D models of this iconic fish. And so I'm currently making a reconstruction based on these 3D fossils. And my aim is to 3D print that. It's kind of hard because fish, because as I said before, they're built out of lots and lots of bits. So I'm not entirely sure how I'm going to attach it all together. But in theory, I'm planning on 3D printing this fish.
I like the ambition again.
There you go. Lizzie, great question. Didn't expect quite such an amazing answer. There you go.
And then hopefully it'll go on display in the museum and glory will await. That's the plan.
Aim, infamy.
I don't know. Yeah, I don't know if that's like you're just being really positive or just really wishful thinking. But I for one would visit a museum to see this three-dimensional skeleton print.
I think the Museum National d'Histoire Naturelle is worth visiting to come and see everything else.
It's so spectacular.
It's got loads of cool stuff in.
I hope I'm thinking of the right gallery, but the one, the evolution gallery, where you walk in and the skeletons are all lined up and like coming towards you. Oh, it's so cool.
Yeah, it's really cool.
Do you get to see that every day when you go into work?
Well, at the moment I see my bedroom walls every day when I go into work.
Oh yeah, lockdown.
Just for a second there, I completely forgot about the pandemic because I was oh my God, I love
that's because you were having
Paris.
Such fun. You were having such fun talking about fishies that you went, the world is not happening right now.
I need to go visit Paris collections, but they're closed to the public at the moment because they're moving stuff around.
Yeah, right? They were moving and they were supposed to be reopening, but then everything set on fire. Oh. So they are, in theory, I think they should be open soon in a normal world, but I'm not the boss of anything, so I can't give you any actual answers.
Yeah, and you don't you're being recorded for perpetuity, so don't yeah. Don't pin yourself down for it.
Yeah. Richard gets fired.
Yeah. Oh, if you got fired, I would give you one paleo point.
Oh, thank you.
Hello.
Yeah. Swings and roundabouts, eh?
Yeah. I'll swap it for a postdoc with someone.
I'm sure someone would trade, in fairness. Well, it's getting to that part of the show where, as we reach towards the tail of the show, if you will, that I ask a ridiculous question. So my question this week for you, Dr. Richard Dearden, is you are, terms and conditions apply, probably paleontology's largest Eurovision fan. And if you were to have to, if you were the representative, say, of the United Kingdom in Eurovision, but your song had to be paleo-themed, what would your song be about? And why would you sing about those, that thing? Whatever that thing is. And I'll give you a minute to think about it, because the other two have heard this question, so I want the answers from them first. So I'm gonna go with Christine first.
So I already had a slamming answer for this earlier, in the fact that I would make my Eurovision Song Contest song about the KPG extinction, the end dinosaur extinction, because it would have the best drop ever. Slamming it. So there.
Oh my god. Great. There's been a lot of puns.
I think it'd be great. You could have like the kind of build up of like the normal kind of life, and then you could have like a really intense section in the middle when the meteorite's crashing in and all the chaos, and then at the end it could kind of like smooth off and have like a nice dreamy sort of, I'm kind of thinking of like Icelandic-y. I saw the Icelandic, or not, the Eurovision film recently, and I can just think of their kind of volcano songs. This is what was kind of firing off in my head.
Yeah, nothing says Eurovision spirit like a mass extinction.
Yeah, it's the themes, you know, everyone coming together, all dying at the same time.
Emma, what's your, but I'm going to move swiftly on from that. Yeah. Emma, what's your Eurovision song entry going to be about? For Ireland, representing the great nation of the Republic of Ireland.
But just so that everybody is aware that Ireland has won the Eurovision the most number of times.
All right, this isn't a bragging contest. This is a question about fossils.
Mostly tailed by Sweden, who are.
Oh, tailed. I see what you did there.
Ah, yes. I genuinely can't think of what exactly I would put in the song, but one thing I would do would make it obnoxiously catchy and have an obnoxious amount of light displays in the background. And I think I'd want it done by people from Sweden because they are amazing. I cannot think of the appropriate content.
I was about to say, you literally just described, you just described a Eurovision song and you didn't even talk about, I didn't hear
I wouldn't know how to win if I wanted to. I don't think I'm going to top Chris's KPG thing. I think that's kind of, I'm still reeling from it a little bit.
That was the nonest answer ever.
I don't know what to do. I have so many choices. Eurovision, I couldn't possibly sully it with paleontology.
You had so much time to mull it over.
I know. I've literally had days. Stop it, Chris.
That was a really good pun, actually. I thought that was
That was very clever. It always makes me suspicious that you've written down a list of fish puns to drop into conversation. Well, yeah.
I mean, if I have to be honest, I think your puns are starting to krill me, but you know, it's fine.
It's not a fish.
Anyway, Richard, I'm going to have to press you for an actual answer if you have one.
Well, I feel like on the basis of loyalty, I'd have to base mine on the sheer wealth of Paleozoic fossil fish, which we get in the UK, which you can find if you pick up a copy of Fossil Fishes of Great Britain by David Downley and Loeffler, I think. No, not Loeffler. I can't remember. David Downley and someone. Then you can go and explore the Paleozoic fossil fishes of Great Britain. So I'm imagining a dark stage, a single spotlight hits it to reveal perhaps a Silurian form. And then the light broadens to reveal a line of people all in sort of comedic full body fish costumes with their legs sticking out. And then a show tune number begins and they start to kick. And that's the kind of spiel of the song.
Wow.
I love it.
That was way more than I thought Yeah, that was good. I like that.
I had visions of Katy Perry's was a Super Bowl performance with the shark. Yeah.
Oh my goodness. Shark. Oh. Yeah. So one of the fish has to go rogue halfway through the performance. Like, just go absolutely ham and start messing. And
I watched an opera once where loads of people were dressed up as giant noses with their legs sticking out the bottom.
And then noses.
Noses. Yeah, like giant noses.
Wait, with the legs sticking out of the nostrils?
I guess, yeah, sort of. But their arms weren't sticking out. It was just noses with legs. The opera is called The Nose. About a man who I think wakes up and has lost his nose. But this is completely off topic. Yeah, well, that,
what you just heard there, ladies and gentlemen, was actual stunned silence. Like, what was... that was weird.
All right, wow. Thomas, bring it in. Tell us your plan.
Well, mine isn't strictly a fossil per se, but having heard Emma's answer, I feel very comfortable with that situation.
I just have too much respect for the Eurovision, as I said, to sully it with any paleontology.
Your country sullied it with Jedwood.
Okay. No. We brought a puppet turkey one year as well, but nobody talks about that. Why is it Jedwood?
Oh dear. So I was going to go more on a taphonomical theme and talk about and have a song about understanding preservation, which is kind of boring, but I was going to use decaying polychaetes. So I was going to get people to dress up as rotting polychaetes, but I kind of feel like you've done the fish costumes now.
Mine weren't rotting, so that might be a vote. People like rotting things on stage. I can't imagine that.
I mean, yeah, it can't be worse than some of the Eurovision entries. So, yeah. Maybe I won't go to where I was thinking.
Like Lady Gaga meat costume.
Oh, can you imagine? Just a costume with just rotting polychaetes all over. Little marine worms everywhere, just stuck to you. Just, are they still wriggling? I don't know. Could you be used as bait? I don't know. Oh, no. That's too much. Too much.
It is the kind of thing that might win, though.
It's pretty out there.
Mm.
It's pretty out there. I don't know. It would need to be like a synth pop ballad, mm-hmm. I think, all about rotting polychaetes. Anyway, I feel like this ridiculous question was maybe a question too far. And I feel a small amount of regret for asking it, if I'm brutally honest.
No regrets, Thomas.
Anyway, well, that's been a very interesting talk. We've still got a few minutes left. I think we're all so disgusted by our answers for Eurovision. If you have any more questions, do fire them in. But I mean, I'm still a little bit curious, though, about these fossil fishes that you have, which is, with all these fossil fishes that you have and that you find and that you CT scan, do you ever have any of them that don't CT scan?
Yeah. What's a good example? So the worst problems I've had have been with stuff where it's sort of been piratized, and then how do you explain piratized in simple terms? I'm not a geologist.
It's a type of rock basically that looks like gold, but it's not gold.
But then it's in CT scans, it looks very you just get kind of white explosions all over because the x-rays don't like it very much. So I've had some like that, which has sort of been horrific.
Okay.
My kind of threshold, because the fish, Paleozoic fish people have really horrible CT data with all these horrible fishes. And we look at scans and we go, oh, that's actually quite nice. And something that like a dinosaur person would be absolutely disgusted by. And so I'm used to horrible data.
There. I actually learned how to use, I think it's a blender using a fish skull. I feel like I got thrown right in the deep end there.
So do you have competitions with other fish workers to see who has the worst scan?
I mean, I guess it's like one of those things where you sort of low-key flex about it at conferences and try and boast about how hard your life is compared to everyone else. Like I'm doing here. Just like this.
And this is why, ladies and gentlemen, that I insinuated earlier that all paleontologists are alcoholics.
We have such weird flexes.
Yeah, we do. Anyway.
Oh, dear me.
I mean, I think after talking about absolutely rubbish fossils, I think that's probably a good place, to end there and to finish.
Actually,
Emma. Oh, oh.
I, Can I jump in, almost trying to redeem myself for the Eurovision fiasco? But Richard, what is your favourite fish? Living?
How did we not ask that? Yeah. How did we not ask that?
I was kind of hoping that no one would ask me this because I struggled to think of a good answer.
Oh, who's struggling now, eh?
Don't worry, I will edit this. I will edit in the podcast version of this. I will edit it so it's A, seamless, and B, so that you don't and ah about what your favourite fish is. So you just like instantly shout it out and it'll be fine. No one will ever know.
So obviously all fish are great, except for the great traitors that went onto land called tetrapods. But other than that...
Wait, so you hate yourself?
Yes.
Oh, wait. That's, I was about to say, that's
why else would I be working
on
fossil fish? But so there's a... I don't know if you've ever seen a upside down catfish.
Oh.
So there's a kind of upside down catfish, I think called a Warindi, and I think lots of them look like this. And they have skeletons where if you look at them, they look almost like a Paleozoic fossil fish. Like they have big dermal plates all over their head and these massive fin spines.
I can hear this
pretty cool
thing of somebody's keyboard
there.
Yeah, sorry,
cool,
that was me. I was desperately Googling what an upside down catfish looks like, but it looks exactly like a catfish that's upside down.
Yeah, but if you find a skeleton, they're pretty cool. And then in terms of fossil ones, Ineopterygians are really cool. I don't know if you've ever seen an Ineopterygian.
I don't even know what that word means.
It's like a chimera from the kind of Carboniferous, which looks like if you took like a fish and then made it look like the weirdest fish you could possibly imagine with all its bits in the wrong place. So it sort of looked like that. It's hard to do. It's hard to explain.
I'm going to take your word that it's amazing, though, because, you know, the hand movements alone, as you were trying to stretch out an imaginary fish and then move the different parts of it around, makes it worthwhile.
That's pretty cool.
Do you have favourite fish, Emma and Chris? Because I have a favourite fish.
I think my favourite might be parrotfish, just because of the noise that they make when they're record or when you can record them like gnawing on stuff.
Who's a pretty boy then?
they're cool even just to look at, but it's just the grinding noise with their little beaks. I think they're cool. Parrotfish for me.
I've never listened to that. Maybe that's it.
YouTube it.
Yeah, it's really creepy. They like it's like it's almost like a sound, isn't it?
Yeah, and it's a noise that you feel like you shouldn't hear from underwater. It feels too like I'm not going to go any further into that because it is a weird sound. But anyway, Chris,
I think I'm going to be really boring and go for the whale shark. I think whale sharks are amazing.
I mean, they're not boring though, are they? Whale sharks, they're pretty amazing.
Yeah, they are. They are amazing. They're just I think there's something so serene about the idea of just like the empty ocean and then just the single huge slow floaty thing.
Yeah, absolutely.
Have you ever seen a megamouth shark?
Megamouth shark.
They're like sort of a hipster whale shark. They're like weird and deep sea but filter feed with big mouths.
There's two things about whale sharks that freak me out. The first thing about whale sharks, it's not strictly about whale sharks, but if you Google whale shark with its mouth closed, they look weird. And it's the same with basking sharks, which are kind of like whale sharks. Like they're filter feeding sharks and we get them around the UK. And if you Google basking shark with its mouth closed, they are, because you only ever see pictures of them when they're basically feeding. Mm. And they look so derpy. They look so weird. I'm just not used to it. Anyway, so that's my first thing. The second thing about whale sharks that freaks me out is that I only recently learned this, but some aquariums in Japan have whale sharks and some aquariums have multiple whale sharks in the same tank. That is, I don't know if that's horrifying or amazing.
Well, I mean, it's still a big question about how whale sharks like spawn, right? Because they migrate enormous distances. And I remember reading something about people tracing all spawning of whale sharks back to like a small area. But no one's ever really been able to figure out the specifics of it, like where they go, what they do, how they pop or whatever they do.
They pop. Is that the technical term? Because if it is, I love it.
I don't know. I mean,
what is a baby shark called? Is it a
shark called pup? Isn't it?
I think it might be a pup. They're kind of weird because they do internal fertilization, not like other fish.
Christine, I nearly gave you a paleo party point, but seeing as you're a paleo party host, you're barred from owning paleo party points.
That's so not fair.
I'm very sorry to inform you.
Damn. Thomas, I'll give you one if you give me one.
No.
Hey, no.
So friend of the show, Jim Jam, he might be the very first person with two paleo points. right? Everyone bear with me. He's just popped into chat saying, and also, wait, I might have to consider this paleo point because he is a fish worker. But he said, apparently, there is ancient Egyptian hieroglyph artwork of upside down catfish.
Yeah, I think there might be.
Oh!
Well, but there's definitely, the one I'm thinking of is actually is an elephant fish, but maybe there is also upside down catfish. Ooh, that'd be cool.
Controversial.
I see Jim Jan has all these points. He sounds like a man who knows his stuff.
Well, he's on 1 point something at the moment points, yeah. Which still makes him the leader. But anyway, that's the story for another. Jim Jan, there'll be a letter will arrive in the post in the next couple of days. Don't worry about it.
Thomas, did you tell us your favourite fish before?
I have not told you my favourite fish, and I've been waiting patiently to tell you my favourite fish. My favourite fish, without a shadow of a doubt, is a fish called the sarcastic fringe head.
Oh yeah, they're good.
And have you heard of the sarcastic fringe head before, Chris?
No.
Right.
No, this is entirely new to me.
Sit and ready yourself for the sarcastic fringe head. So the fringe head is it's a kind of small saltwater fish. And it lives, I think it lives on the North American coast, if I remember correctly. It's an unassuming looking fish. It's sort of greeny, browny color. Stick with me here. So it lives in little burrows, okay? And it is incredibly territorial, like insanely, so territorial, it will attack, as inverted commas, it doesn't attack, it like swims at them aggressively, but it will go for divers who are swimming past, right? But the thing that makes the sarcastic fringe head amazing is that it opens its jaw, and when it opens its jaw, it flaps out cheeks to make this giant triangle of skin that's like twice as large as the fish itself, and then it basically uses that to ward off predators and to fight other fringe heads. And what they do is two fringe heads will open these triangular flaps of skin and then basically just headbutt each other until one of them backs down. And please, if you do one thing today, dear listeners, go online and Google the sarcastic fringe head, because it will make your evening. I promise.
It's terrifying.
That is a Thomas Clements guarantee. Anyway, on that bombshell... We've gone over an hour now.
many fish to talk about?
An amazing, amazing question. And I'm actually ashamed that we didn't ask that question earlier. But anyway, so I'm going to end the show there. We're back again in 2 weeks. But don't forget that you can listen to us on Spotify or Anchor or pretty much anywhere where you get your podcast from. We are being really good at updating our website. Emma is doing an amazing job at keeping that up to date. It has all of our information on it about our next guests. It has loads of useful links. And also, don't forget to follow us on Twitter. Chris has been doing an amazing job with fish facts in advance of our stream. And I'm sure there's going to be loads more threads of interesting facts in the run-up to the next stream. So do follow us on Paleo Party. And I just want to say thank you so much to our guest, Richard Deirdrin. And we've had such a lovely time. So mini round of applause.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you very much for having me.
And I'm going to leave it there and say goodbye. And we hope to see you again next stream. So goodbye.
Ciao.
Bye.